I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The Orlando Magic are working on a deal that will likely send Dwight Howard out of Orlando and possibly to the Brooklyn Nets. That would leave Orlando's NBA team without its star player only weeks after the team fired its head coach. I'll talk with Orlando Magic CEO Alex Martins about turmoil on the team. Plus, a University of Central Florida writing instructor is trying to revive creative writing skills in young students in the age of tweeting and texting. That's ahead on Intersection. It's been a bumpy couple of months for the Orlando Magic. The NBA team lacks a head coach. The future of its star player, Dwight Howard, is uncertain. Its front office went through a major shakeup. Now a new general manager is trying to smooth things out. But the implications are big for Orlando, a city that invested millions in the team's new state-of-the-art venue, the Amway Center. Alex Martins was appointed the Magic's chief executive officer in December 2011 after more than a decade on and off with the team. Good to have you in, Alex.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I got to ask you this. Everyone is dying to know, what's going on with Dwight Howard? What's next for the big guy?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, at this point in time, because of where we are in the NBA's moratorium period, we're not allowed to comment publicly on any players that are being discussed, particularly in free agency. So, unfortunately, we can't really discuss that today until we get into the signing period on July 11th.
Well, let me ask you, though, maybe you can comment a little bit about some of the stuff that's led up to where we are today. Dwight Howard, of course, has been a star player for the Orlando Magic for many years and really beloved by the Orlando community, Central Florida community. You've got a new manager in, and this is all coming about because there's been a shakeup in the Orlando Magic's key players in terms of managing the team. You've got a new general manager, and you're looking for a head coach at this point. Talk to me a little bit about what led to where we are right now.
Well, the bottom line for us as an organization is we continue, towards our goal to try and win an NBA championship. And in order to do that, we believe that, we have to have players on our team that want to be here and that are going to work hard towards working towards that NBA championship. And, I think in terms of what has led to some of Dwight's decisions, we need to ask him that as to the reasons why, he has made the requests that he's made here recently in terms of being traded, et cetera. But I think for us, the most important thing is that we have to do what's in the best interest of the organization with players who want to be on the Orlando Magic, represent the Orlando community, and, work towards our goal of winning an NBA championship.
And for our listeners that don't know, the talk has been that Dwight Howard is going to hopefully, for him, get traded to the Brooklyn Nets, possibly. At least that's the latest buzz that we're hearing, and I understand your position. Well, talk to me a little bit about Rob Hennigan, who has come in as general manager for the Magic. It's our understanding that he came in with the goal of trying to keep Howard on the team.
Rob's goal, again, is to do everything we need to do to put a championship organization together. He's got a very strong approach and vision as to how you do that. It's with players who want to be part of that organization. It's with players that want to work hard, that want to develop their game, that carry themselves with a high level of character in representing the Orlando community. And so everything that he is doing in terms of formulating the future of the organization really points towards that vision and towards that cultural approach to building a basketball operation. The reason why we hired Rob is because of a few things. Number one, he's got a tremendous background with championship-level organizations, grew up in the San Antonio Spurs organization. The last few years has been the assistant general manager in Oklahoma City, and we all know their success in the last few years. And both of those organizations really focus on building their basketball operation in similar fashions, where you do have hardworking players who want to develop their game, who really focus on the concept of team and not individual effort. and you know, players who ultimately want to work hard to improve their game as a team to get towards that approach of winning a championship. And everything that Rob has done in these first few weeks on the job has been focused on creating that type of culture in our basketball operation.
And Hennigan is an interesting professional in the fact that he's the youngest general manager in the entire NBA right now.
Yeah, and I like to say that, you know, he's got experience beyond his years, quite frankly, because of the organizations that he's worked with and, you know, the responsibilities that he was able to be given and ultimately execute, you know, in San Antonio and Oklahoma City. So, you know, age is not a factor here. Rob, you know, certainly in these first few weeks has already given the indication that, you know, he's capable of operating with any other general manager in the NBA, held himself incredibly well and conducted a great NBA draft, you know, very strategic in his approach. And I think that, you know, all of his other conversations relative to continuing to build the roster, any other changes that need to be made, he's proven himself to be ready, you know, for the task.
Risky to make a gamble on someone like that? I mean, you obviously mentioned he has experience, but did it take some convincing for either yourself or the DeVos family?
Well, you know, certainly he shined during the interview process. You know, I would have to say that, you know, he wasn't a quote-unquote front runner coming into the interview process, but we had heard a lot about him. You know, talked to a lot of his colleagues at San Antonio and Oklahoma City who clearly maintained that he was ready for the challenge. His experience and his background prepared him to be able to take on that role. And as we went through the interview process, he continued to shine above the rest and really, from a cultural standpoint, fit in with our organization very, very well. You know, we really felt that it was not much of a risk overall because of the experience that he did have and the approach and really the methods that he proved to us that he was going to implement, you know, once in the role.
Do you think it's a challenging path forward, though, to come in the midst of turmoil? I mean, you've got a star player that's leaving. You've got no head coach right now, and he's filling the general manager's shoes. So that sounds like full plate.
Well, it certainly wasn't a normal transition where you come in and you get to take some time to, you know, to build your basketball operation. But we had those discussions during the interview process, and Rob, you know, felt that he was definitely up for it. I feel that he's been up for it, you know, in the way that he's carried himself and the way that he's executing on his role and the need to address those issues. So, you know, it was no surprise. Yes, he had to hit the ground running, and I think he has done it very, very well. You know, I think in normal circumstances, maybe he would have preferred to not have so many tasks on his plate immediately, but he's handled them all very, very well.
What's your read, Alex Martins, on the morale of the team in the midst of all this transition and turmoil? Tough to keep a group of guys like that focused?
Well, I think a lot of them have been wondering what the direction is going to be like. And one of the very first things that Rob did in his very first day on the job was to call every one of our players and to talk to them about his vision of building a championship organization and to talk to them about the manner in which it had been done in San Antonio and Oklahoma City. And see, the other thing, you know, about Rob and our approach in hiring Rob is, you know, we want to build sustainable success. You know, we don't want to go, you know, through these peaks and valleys, you know, every 4 or 5 years in terms of success and then, you know, having to rebuild again. And that's what San Antonio and Oklahoma City have proven to be able to do, is to have long-term sustainable success, you know, with the program and the plan that they've developed. And so Rob, you know, had a conversation with every one of our players about that. And the fact that, you know, we're in it to build a championship organization for the long term. And all of our players have gotten comfortable with Rob, I believe, and, you know, certainly is, you know, he's had discussions with the players who have been on our team as well as those we've acquired through the draft recently. There's a lot of excitement about the future of the organization from a player standpoint.
Do you feel like the Magic had gotten in that pattern of peaks and valleys, and is this a strategy shift then to try to go to something more sustainable towards a championship?
This is definitely a strategy shift, and, you know, if you look at the 20 years of the history of our organization, we've had great success. We've been to the NBA Finals twice. The period of time that the DeVos family has owned the Orlando Magic, we're tied for the best winning percentage in all of the Eastern Conference. So we've had some great success. But we've also had, you know, some valleys after Shaq left and, you know, certainly during the course of the last 10 years and trying to rebuild that, you know, there have been peaks and valleys. And so this is a bit of a strategy shift, there's no doubt. We'd like to see more sustainable success so that, like the San Antonio Spurs in the Western Conference, you know, we can be competing for a conference championship every year, despite the fact that pieces come and go in the form of players.
Do you think that means less focus on building a successful team around, say, a star player or just a few key players?
I think it's a strategy that really focuses on team and focusing on the fact that everybody on the team has their role, and not necessarily a star player that's going to drive, you know, the process that, you know, on any given night, any one of our players, you know, should be prepared to be the star and to carry the team, you know, depending upon the situation. It is a more balanced approach, I guess I would say, as opposed to centered around, you know, one key player. So in that regard, yes, you know, it's a bit of a strategy shift and a different way to compose your roster, looking for the different types of players that can complement each other, as opposed to looking for the players that you put around a superstar type player.
Do you feel you tried that twice, maybe with Shaq and with Howard, and you said, you know what, it's not working?
Well, you know, it certainly, you know, didn't get us to the level of success that we wanted to, and that's ultimately to win a championship. And then, unfortunately, it wasn't able to be sustained. You know, that model, you know, is dependent upon going out and getting free agents and putting free agents, you know, in a lot of pieces around a superstar. Whereas when you build organically through the draft, in developing your own players, you can have pieces that come and go from year to year, and improve your team, or, you know, bring in additional complements to your team to help that sustainability, so that you're not relying so much on the big home run with a free agent signing that, you know, in a couple of cases in which we've had over the last couple of years, perhaps overpaying for a player, you know, in that attempt to hit the home run for that piece around a superstar.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Orlando Magic CEO Alex Martins. I'm Mark Simpson. Where do you think the Magic should go from here? You can tell us about it on Facebook or Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, or if you want to just send a good old-fashioned email, it's intersection@WMFE.org. Alex, I want to ask you about Stan Van Gundy, obviously someone who had been with the organization for quite a while. He was let go in May, and a lot of Van Gundy's departure has been shadowed within this conflict over Dwight Howard. Help me sort it out here. What happened there?
Well, we just determined as an organization it was time for change. You know, Stan, I have said several times, Stan is one of the best strategists in the NBA, and he's a great coach, but, you know, there was another part of the job, another part of the balance that we felt we weren't receiving, you know, in that regard. And, you know, it really wasn't a decision that was based on Dwight Howard. It was a decision that was based on a number of different factors. Ultimately, we felt that, you know, we weren't heading in a direction of where we wanted to go, and that is towards winning a championship. As a matter of fact, we felt that we were taking a step back over the last couple of years, having gotten knocked out in the first round of the playoffs. So we just felt that it was really time for a change.
You know, part of the saga of this story is that it did kind of erupt into the papers publicly, Howard saying one thing against Gundy, Gundy saying one thing against Howard. When you look at something like that, is that when it hit the nail on the head for you, or you felt like it was a while coming?
No, again, this wasn't a decision that was focused on Dwight and Stan Van Gundy's relationship. You know, that was, you know, a factor that played out during the course of the year, but the decision was made for a number of different factors beyond that, and primarily the direction of our team and where we felt we were headed and what we needed in order to, you know, to continue to move forward. And we just felt that it was time for change.
Were the other players upset at Van Gundy's dismissal?
I wouldn't characterize it as upset. You know, they were disappointed. Some of them were. You know, a lot of the players liked Stan and liked, you know, what he did for them as players and developing them. But they also understand that, you know, it's part of the business in trying to continue to improve. And particularly when you're an organization that is trying to win a championship, they understand that change is part of our world. And, you know, they're looking forward to that next step with a new head coach.
You know, you personally came under some criticism from Stan Van Gundy's brother, Jeff Van Gundy, who's a TV commentator. He made an accusation on a radio show criticizing your handling of his brother's firing, saying you were disingenuous by giving another reason for firing his brother. Obviously, there's a family tie in there, but, I mean, how do you respond?
You know, we're all going to have our critics, and, you know, no one's going to agree with every decision that we make, you know, particularly when, you know, there's a family tie there. I just see it as part of the business, you know, that we have to understand that every move that we make is not going to please everyone, and there's going to be our critics out there, and we just can't let it affect us, and we need to move forward in trying to create a, you know, a positive atmosphere for the organization in the future.
What are you looking forward to in a new head coach?
I'm looking forward to someone who is a teacher, someone who really is going to focus on developing our players, someone who is going to utilize all of the assets of the organization to be successful, including his assistant coaches, someone who is going to be well-prepared, a great strategist, and ultimately someone who's got experience of having worked with championship-type organizations, similar to the recruiting process, you know, in hiring Rob Hennigan. We want to focus on someone who's actually been in that championship organization. That's what we've missed as an organization. You know, we've got that last 10%, so to speak, that we haven't gotten over the years in order to win a championship. Again, we've gotten to the finals, but we haven't had that last 10%. And to bring in people who've been through that or have been with organizations who have done that to us will allow us to bring that level of experience to the table that perhaps we haven't had here before.
I understand you've gotten the list down pretty short. Some contenders we've got: Michael Malone of the Golden State Warriors, Brian Shaw, Indiana Pacers, Quinn Snyder with the LA Lakers, and Jacques Vaughn of San Antonio Spurs. Why do those individuals stand out for you?
Well, we've been pretty consistent through both the general manager's search process and the coaching process that, you know, we're not talking publicly, you know, about the search itself, other than the fact to say that, you know, our goals, as I've outlined, you know, just previous here, are, you know, to try and attract that type of head coach. And as we go through this process, we're not going to continue to focus on individuals or where we are in a timeline. We're just going to stay focused on trying to find the individual that meets that criteria that we outlined a little earlier for a head coach.
How soon do you think you want to get someone in that slot?
I don't think there's any rush, so to speak, because of a couple of different factors. There's really nobody else out in the marketplace looking for a head coach right now, so there's no risk of losing you know, any of the gentlemen that we're focused on. And also, you know, there's no rush in terms of, you know, the coach interacting with our players, because at this time of year, we really can't have any workouts, and you know, it's all preparation time. So I would say, you know, our general manager Rob Hennigan has pointed out that our hope is that we have it done by the end of July, but you know, we're certainly not going to be tied to a timeline. We don't have to be at this time of year.
Do you feel that in terms of prospects looking at that job, they look at the Orlando Magic organization and say, whoa, these guys are in the middle of something big here. Maybe this isn't the place that I want to go if I've got something safe and secure where I am right now.
Well, I would say to you that the organization has a great reputation in the league. The DeVos family are known as one of the best owners in the NBA. You know, we have a great reputation for the manner in which we operate our organization. We have a great reputation for the manner in which we treat our employees and our players. We've got great facilities. Everybody knows that we've got the greatest arena in the NBA to play in. And, you know, for a lot of these gentlemen, it's an opportunity to be a part of building a championship organization. So I think there's a lot of positive things that, you know, potential candidates would look at in this opportunity, much more so than you know, the fact that we're going through some change right now.
Talk with me a little bit about that new Amway Center. You were pretty heavily involved in helping to make that deal possible, part of this three-pack of venues in downtown Orlando. And, of course, the Amway Center was finished first, and there was some debate about whether or not that was the right thing to do. A lot of folks in the arts community thought Orlando needed a performing arts center before they needed a new venue for the Magic to play in. So talk to me about your role in the Amway Center project, making those deals happen, and what do you think about the outcome?
I think from our perspective, the DeVosses, from a financial perspective, put more into that public facility than any NBA owner has put into a publicly owned venue. So, we certainly believe that we have done our fair share. The community has benefited from that facility beyond the Orlando Magic. Now, every concert and family show that were passing us by in the past are coming to the venue. As a matter of fact, now all the people over in Tampa are complaining that they're missing out on shows because they're all going to the Amway Center. So the community has benefited greatly and will continue to benefit greatly. Another example is, we just released an economic impact study last week of the NBA All-Star Weekend from this past February. And this independent study, came to the conclusion that there was $95 million worth of economic impact that was brought to our community because of that event and because of the fact that it was held at the Amway Center. And that event would not have come here if we didn't have a new venue. So those are the kind of events that that venue can attract that can have a positive economic impact on our community. And I know the Central Florida Sports Commission is working very hard right now also to bring a lot of other big type events to the venue, like an SEC Men's Basketball Championship or the NCAA Basketball Championship and the like.
I've been speaking with Orlando Magic CEO Alex Martins. Alex, thanks so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, teaching teens the lost art of writing in today's age of tweeting, texting, and Facebook. Children today have more communication tools available to them than previous generations, but their communication skills are suffering. That's the position Terry Thaxton, associate professor of English at the University of Central Florida, says. Thaxton has organized summer writing camps for middle and high school students, which are aimed at strengthening their writing skills weakened by texts and tweets. The camps are underway this week at UCF, and Terry is here to talk to us about it. Good to have you in, Terry.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So talk to me about this. How do you see kids' language changing at those early ages, middle school and high school, and how do you see it through the filter of social media, texting and tweeting?
I'm no expert in social media and literacy and how it's affected that, so I haven't done any research on that. But I do think that social media has made writing skills much more a part of everyday life. I do think what it has done is brought to the into focus for the general public the lack of writing skills among kids.
So highlighting an issue and a problem.
Right, right. I see my nieces and nephews posting things on Facebook with all the abbreviated symbols and text-like messages. And I think they're even aware that they're not spelling correctly, that they're not, they don't have the language to write a complete sentence yet. So I do think that social media has made us all much more aware of a problem that teachers have seen for a long time.
So part of getting kids to write better is helping them to access their imagination. How do you do that?
We access that through fun and engaging exercises that creative writers use all the time. When we've worked with children or young adults or teens, we provide small little prompts that get them to both use an element of craft, so for example, figurative language, as well as their imaginations. So we might take in flowers and give each kid a flower and ask them to describe the flower in terms of taste, not to encourage them to eat the flower.
Although some you could.
You could. and then we also try to get them to use rhyme and sounds of language.
Do you think, and then extrapolate that for me, when you get into social media, something mm-hmm. like Twitter, where you've got that 140 character limit, tough to get imagination and creativity into those tweets, or that's become something of a science in itself in the Twitterverse?
It has, in fact. There are, in fact, UCF offers an MFA in emerging media, a Master's of Fine Arts in Emerging Media through the School of Visual Arts and Design. And there are more and more literary artists, more and more creative writers are using social media, Twitter, Facebook, blogs, all sorts of social media to write and also to market themselves, of course. But there are several literary magazines that use Twitter, either as poetry teasers. There are a few literary journals that are actually publishing poems that are tweets. So I think writers are learning how to incorporate the new media into the artistry.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Terry Thaxton, who is teaching summer writing camps aimed at strengthening children's writing skills in this age of tweets and texts. I'm Mark Simpson. Tell us, how do you think social media might be impacting your communication skills? Well, tell us through social media. Find us Facebook or WMFE Orlando on Twitter, or you can send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. So, Terry, what do you know about the background of the middle school and high school students you're going to be working with in these camps, and how are you preparing for that, and what are you expecting is going to be the outcome?
The Creative Writing Summer Camp is an extension of what the Literary Arts Partnership at UCF has been doing for about 9 years. I'm hoping that the outcome is going to be a new excitement for language or a validation of some of the talents of the kids who show up.
How do you get students, though, to get over that hump? Because writing, it's a process, right? There's the drafts, there's revisions, and it can be hard when you read something that's great and you think, I want to write that right now. And then you look at what you have and you go, oh, my God, that's not it. Yeah. How do you get people to keep coming back, not give up, have that persistence to continue?
I think that persistence comes from within. I think a lot of students do come and think the first thing they put on the page is going to be it, the end, done.
We would all love that.
We would love that. I would love that.
That would make things a lot easier.
That would be great. But once they start hearing their own words, so what we do at each session that we do, whether it's through the summer camp or throughout the year, we work with nursing homes, persons with Alzheimer's, we work with children in homeless shelters, we work with youth in foster care facilities, whatever venue. At the end of each session, we ask participants to read back their writing. When they start to hear their own writing, they really want it to be correct. They really want it to be clear. They want their words to be understood by you. And that gets them to want to make it better. So often we'll have students say, I want you to rewrite it so that it sounds right. And then what we do is we start getting them to read it aloud again and ask them to put in their own corrections. We also, after a writing session with students, we take the writing that they've handwritten, we take it home or back to the office, type it out, bring it back to them, and have them read it out loud. They'll often say, you didn't type this correctly. And we'll get them to correct it. And then we retype.
So the big question is, you're going to be teaching these fundamentals of writing and accessibility, or are you going to be tweeting about it?
I'm going to be writing about it.
Very good. We've been speaking with Terry Thaxton, Associate Professor of English at the University of Central Florida. Thaxton has organized summer writing camps for middle and high school students aimed at strengthening writing skills weakened by maybe tweeting and texting a little too much. Good luck with it, Terry, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Do you use Twitter or Facebook in your creative writing? Tell us about it. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WMFE Orlando, or email intersection@WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.